Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University. I'm joined today on Frankly Speaking by my friends from the GCSA's Government Relations Department, Bob Hyland. Bob is the Director of Congressional and Federal Affairs for the GCSA, and Michael Lee, who just joined the GCSA as of the recording of this podcast, is the Manager of Government Relations. And both of them, as you might imagine, in their roles have matured a long time away from the golf industry, because both of them, I was saying to them earlier before we got on, I have shoes older than they've been working for the GCSA. But that is not as to say that we are not well served as an industry with these two fine gentlemen that work for one of the finest people I know, and certainly one of the smartest, in Hava McKeel, who I must say, Bob, while I want to welcome you to the program, I actually don't know what Hava's job is. Is she like the czar of government relations? How does that work?
I think she's all of that put together, frankly, Frank. She's very motivated for the industry, for advocacy. She works very hard to make sure that golf's voice is heard. And it's worked wonders for our industry as we're celebrating our 10th year of National Golf Day. We're doing our advocacy efforts here across the country and throughout the year. We've moved a lot of points forward with some people here in D.C. and otherwise to make sure golf's being heard.
What a great segue. And because where it's going to be heard is not just in Washington, but also back at the grassroots level. And welcome Michael Lee, the manager of government relations, that I believe, Michael, you are charged with managing the grassroots ambassador program.
You got it, Frank. That's primarily what Hava brought me on board to manage. And I can tell you, Hava was sad she couldn't join us this morning, but she's an incredible department leader, and she's assembled a great team here. I'm really excited to be a part of it. But yeah, I'm focusing mostly on our grassroots initiatives. Our grassroots ambassador program is sort of our formal effort, and it's our tie that our members have directly with members of Congress. So that's my big focus right now. I'm growing the program each and every day, trying to recruit new ambassadors to join, and I'm really excited about the future of it.
Great. Well, we are off to a good start here, fellas. We'll be right back after a message from our sponsors. This is Frankly Speaking, and we'll be back with GCSA's Bob Hyland and Michael Lee.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Frank Rossi here on the TurfNet Radio Network. Where we left off, we were about to get started yakking about what's going on in the government relations department, so aptly led by Hava McKeel, as these two fine gentlemen just told us. Bob, you're going to take this one. 10 years of Golf Day, but we've been in government relations and advocacy even before Hava was on board. Do you know much of the history of this whole thing to bring us up to speed?
I do. I've been working with them in both directly now and indirectly when I represented them in Washington on advocacy level. And I can tell you that we've had a concerted effort since the beginning of the century. We've been able to cover all 50 states, cover all levels of government with our advocacy efforts here at the GCSAA. We have a 5-year strategic business plan in place with 6 strategic goals for advocacy. Michael is our full-time government affairs manager, and he's working hard and working on the ambassador program, but we go beyond that. My presence here in Washington is part of that, here as boots on the ground in D.C. We go beyond that. We deal with compliance issues. We deal with advocacy, as I said, at all levels at 50 government in the 50 states, plus we have a field staff in place with 9 field representatives representing golf courses around the country. We have our industry partners. We have our chapters, and then, of course, the ambassador program. So it's a concerted approach to move advocacy forward and to make sure golf's voice is heard.
And so in the time that you've worked with and you know, sort of cooperatively in your role when you were based in D.C. and now as part of the whole operation, what would you say has been your biggest success in the years? I mean, to me, it seems like we really, I mean, as hard as HAVA was working, it's clear now with the addition of you two that there were great needs for a long time that, you know, that maybe now we're really starting to think about this is a very effective way to do it. Obviously, you guys are offering way more services. You weren't covering 50 states 10 years ago, were you?
Right. I mean, I think the biggest achievement we have here is visibility. We suffered, golf suffered, and unfortunately still suffers to a degree with a perception problem, which is, yeah, and we have, and the concern with that perception problem is that we're fighting people who think we either are worthy of penalty or we don't deserve assistance. It's one or the other. And the visibility, the higher profile that we've been the profile that we've been increasing over the last 10 years has resulted in people taking us seriously at the decision-making level in Washington and at the level in the states. It's very important for us.
Okay, listen, Bob. You just said two really interesting things, and I want to make sure I heard it right. A lot of time, what you described is what I believe, particularly in a state like New York, where I practice my craft as an extension scientist, that there's this sense that golf has a bad perception, that we're worthy of penalty, and did you say don't deserve to exist?
No, don't deserve to be benefited.
Don't deserve benefit.
I mean, that's the whole point behind the disaster relief exclusion that we saw after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Relief went out to a number of businesses that were suffering in the Gulf area after those terrible natural disasters. And instead of being added to the list of eligible entities, golf was excluded from the benefits, the tax credits and the like that came about. So that's my point, that we're not being considered as worthy to be helped.
So why aren't they viewed? Now, let me ask you, since we're in this deep dive now into this particular aspect, why wouldn't a golf course be viewed as a small business?
Oh, I think there's this sin, quote unquote, sin industry list. And people don't see the small business side of it because of that. They lump us with other entities that are self-sufficient, able to help themselves out. And they don't see that golf is predominantly a small business.
Well, it is. Well, no matter who it's serving, it's a small business until you get to the sort of upper level resort and, you know, those types of operations. But, you know, you're talking about the rank and file of golf course operators in the United States are public golf courses trying to make a living on a tee sheet, or a real estate investment who's now trying to figure out without real estate to sell, and they got this amenity that costs them $1 million to manage, and they can't even get the people around the golf course to want to join the club. I mean, it's those kinds of operations. Do you find any success in sort of trying to characterize it with people as a farm? I mean, I own a farm with my wife, and what people don't realize, it's a small business. I mean, we are only doing $25,000-$35,000 worth of revenue and toil and sweat and lots of, you know, pig manure, but you know, what I'm saying is, why aren't these things viewed like that?
Well, maybe the answer to that question is that we're getting there. It's funny you should talk about farms, because I do a lot of work with the ag industries here in Washington. And one of my colleagues and counterparts said to me, he said, you're an ag entity. Your commodity is turf. And I had to think about that, and it struck me as odd at the moment. But I thought, you know, there's some truth to some of that.
Well, of course, if you had to make an argument, you could call us agritourism, because we do invite people to go around the farm. Like when we make a certain percentage of our income on my farm, I'm with my wife's farm that I'm the director of waste management for. And we bring people in for tours. And that's part of what we do. Why couldn't a golf course be considered part of the hospitality industry, like a hotel and like a restaurant, which maybe they have sometimes, and or a farm? It seems like that perception problem ought to be one, because everybody loves a farm.
Right, right. I think there's a perception problem, as you're indicating. I can understand that we need to raise that visibility. I'm proud to say that what I'm doing here in DC, when I interact with other interest groups such as these, is that I'm part of the discussion, and that makes it very helpful.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so, listen, I want to give Michael a chance, because I think being part of the discussion, not just the discussion we're having here, but how superintendents can become part of the discussion for their business operation. I mean, they're a member. If you look at a golf course as a small business, they're the facility manager, essentially, and they're being asked to advocate for the facility. I'm assuming the CMAA is doing it, and other parts of golf are doing it. Certainly the professional golfers show up at golf day for sure. But Michael, you're now charged with building the capacity amongst the rank and file of our members and allied members to sort of go and be part of this conversation. I'm imagining that strategic plan that Bob outlined includes objectives and goals for you. Talk a little bit about the ambassador program, how it's been going, and what you'll see going forward.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Frank. And I appreciate you highlighting the ambassador program, because it's something that we're very excited about here at GCSAA. The program started in the summer of 2014 with the vision of connecting better with Congress. And we wanted to get our members, our general membership, more involved in that process. I mean, Hava and Bob and I, we work in government affairs day in and day out. But we knew that there was a strong interest from our membership in getting involved in the legislative process and the creation of policy and regulations that they all have to abide by on a daily basis in the management of their golf course. And who better to speak to members of Congress about the turf industry and the issues it faces than ambassadors and superintendents themselves? The ambassador program is specifically for Class A, B, and C members of GCSA, so those are all superintendents. And got off to a great start in the summer of 2014, and it's only grown since then. So as we sit here today, Frank, we have 275 grassroots ambassadors. And the way the program is structured is that as an ambassador, you're paired with one member of Congress. So our goal is by the year 2020 to have one ambassador paired with each and every 535 members of Congress. And it's based off your facility location. So your golf course sits within a congressional district, and that is the member of Congress that you would be paired with, either on the House side or with one of your two senators from your state. So it's a program that I'm really excited to be in charge of, because I worked for a United States Senator, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, prior to joining GCSAA. I'm from Oklahoma originally, and I went to work for him right out of college. And so my background is in constituency engagement. That's what I did for 8 years under Senator Inhofe. I was always looking for good opportunities to connect constituents across the state of Oklahoma with our congressional office to get their feedback, hear their questions and concerns about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and how they could play a role in that. And that's precisely what we're doing with the ambassador program.
And I tell you, it is so great to hear you talk like this, because when I hear you describe, you know, the things that are that the ambassadors are going to be doing, as I said to you before we went on the show, is, boy, I believe that's a capacity that will help them in their day-to-day job, because they're, you know, when they're trying to interact with their representative and representing constituents, they have to have a broad perspective of the issues. And I think that's sometimes important on a golf course, that sometimes golf course superintendents get lost sort of literally in the weeds of, man, I got to get this course. The green's got to be 11. The tee's got to be level. The fairway's got to be mowed. No, you know, all the things to prepare the playing surfaces. And they're not necessarily sort of looking at the broad perspective of the entire club. I got to believe you've gotten some feedback, even in just a few months, because you had the boot camp, I would imagine, or you must have done some training at the conference, the GIS down in Orlando. Are you getting feedback from guys that they feel like it's helping them in other parts of their professional life?
Well, you nailed it, Frank. It's almost as if you were at the boot camp that we had in Orlando at the Golf Industry Show just a month ago. We brought in a great advocacy trainer named Chris Cush, who has a company in D.C., and he trains associations all across the country on how to be great advocates. And one of the first exercises that Chris had our ambassadors do, and we had a great turnout. We had about 100 ambassadors at boot camp this year. It was really great. But one of the first exercises that they did was called the five introductions. And it was basically, think about how you talk to your colleagues and talk to folks in your community about your golf course. What's its history? Who was the last person you hired? What makes it unique? What's a unique program or initiative you have going on at your golf course? How do you formulate those things into a coherent thought and presentation? And so, like you said, I mean, that really gets superintendents and ambassadors outside of their daily work managing the course and forces them to think about the big picture. And so I think our ambassadors do see that, and they enjoy the professional growth that they get out of it.
And boy, I tell you, listening to you talk, I have, every time you make a little another statement, I have five more questions. But fellas, we're not going to be able to, there's not going to be enough internet space left for the conversation we'd record if I kept asking the questions that come to mind. So we're going to take a break for a message from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with Bob Hyland and Michael Lee from the GCSA. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. Okay, fellas, you guys are great. This, I got to tell you, Michael, before we go back, this grassroots thing, as you've just described it, and I've been thinking about it, I wasn't at that boot camp, just so you know. I didn't, you know, this is how I view this thing. But my sense is that the GCSA has been trying to get improvement in communication and making the guys better at the soft skills they need to survive in a facility where, you know, politics and egos and other things can be involved, and they're aware of them and they complain about them. But I think what you're training them on is going to help them develop skills that they might not otherwise think they would even use. It's almost like it's a bait and switch. You're giving them skills without telling them where they could use them. And that's a whole conversation in of itself, because that is such a weak area. I believe it's inherent in the personality of golf superintendents there. The majority of them are inherently introverted, because if you were an extrovert, you wouldn't take a job that required you to ride a mower for 6 hours a day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay, so go ahead, Michael.
It's been great to see their growth. You know, it's something new, brand new for most of them. They've never delved into politics or the world of politics or Congress or how any of it works. So for them to jump in, they're really kind of having to get outside of their comfort zone. And I'm thrilled to be a part of it. I mean, it's really fun to see these guys grow in that regard.
Great. Okay, so we'll take a break. I'll take a 5-second pause, and then Bob will come right back to the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot Washington report to see where we can go with how you're approaching the thing there. So let's get quiet, and then we'll come right back to Bob.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi on the TurfNet Radio Network, joined today Bob Hyland, Michael Lee, both from the GCSAA government advocacy and government advocacy department that HAVA we have heard from both of the gentlemen is leading so aptly. And when we left the conversation, we were talking about building capacity with golf course superintendents to have with their policymakers, both Bob in the Washington conversation, and to a certain extent, if you divvied it up, Michael keeping that local constituency engaged in the conversation. Now, here's the question, Bob. I'm not so sure people would characterize what's going on in Washington as so much a conversation as much as a shouting match and tweet fest and whatever else we want to make a joke about it. But these issues have real implications for golf superintendents. And if we continue along the lines that these are small business operators that manage land-based businesses that touch, you know, natural resources and labor issues, immigration issues by inherently like that, transportation issues, if there are things moving around, they have to transport things. So obviously our business touches a lot of things and we could make lots of jokes about it. But I guess let's just get right at how would you characterize in your career of Washington what you're seeing right now? You know, we saw an Obama revolution, and now it looks like you're seeing some sort of Trump revolution. How would you characterize what's going on from a broad perspective?
Well, I can understand for someone, for anyone, for people watching this outside of the Beltway, wondering how this is managing to move and how government stays in place. But I'm positive about this. I see this as democracy in action. People want to be heard. People want their voices to be heard. And they have a right to be heard. So on the broader perspective, we're managing golf's interests no matter who wins the White House. We would have done it the same if Hillary Clinton had won. And we're doing it the same with Donald Trump in the Oval Office. We see this as no different. The rules all are the same in terms of how things get done. And it's just a little more more visible, maybe a little more messier. But frankly, our eyes are not off the ball on our agenda and our goals. You know, a little bit of basics. So Trump's in the White House. The Democrats are in the minority in both the House and the Senate. The Republican Party controls the Senate only by a 52-48 majority. So for most legislation, they still have to reach across the aisle and get the Democrats' help and buy in on a lot of bills. So our bipartisan approach for lobbying is never going to change. I get a lot of questions about Trump. I've done a few interviews now over the past few weeks, and I get the same question. Does the fact that we have a golf course owner in the White House have our agenda? And I'll approach that question head on because I get it a lot. The answer is yes, and we're pleased to have someone in the White House who supports our agenda, who supports golf, and who is making some moves in the right direction in that area. But we don't take anything for granted in terms of what he does. And I can talk about some of the individual issues we're following and how they're moving, but I don't see that anything has changed with regards to the executive branch. There's still the agency level. There's still rules that were govern how those agencies can act and what they may do in terms of rulemaking, et cetera. And there's still Congress with the balance that I mentioned to you, which means they're going to have a voice to be heard on this. So,
well, listen, you know, yeah, and I tell you, I think you did an excellent job there. To be honest, I hear that question so much that I believe what you believe. There's a lots of things between him, his golf, and making decisions that, you know, might favor what he's doing or golf over another. I feel very confident that, first of all, from an environmental perspective that I care about, and I know the golf course superintendents care about as an industry, and I believe golf cares about as an industry, that we're not advocating a platform that puts the environment at risk. I believe that this is an industry that's consistently asked for reasonable regulations. And I believe, and I'll say it frankly, because, you know, it's my show and I get in trouble for it. But I think sometimes standing next to chemical companies when you're having these conversations with environmental groups works against us in some ways, even though we know we're partners with them and they'll be at National Golf Day. And I'm not casting dispersions. But when I think about our agenda from an environmental perspective, I'm very confident that we're promoting an agenda that's not contrary to what I, as a lefty liberal, believe. I mean, I'm not, you know, sitting around moping that he's the president. I'm also not sitting around thinking we're going to get away with murder because he's a golf course, because, I don't know, Eisenhower was a golf guy. Can we look back in history and see, was there any favorable golf legislation that he put in there? Or the thing that gets messy with Trump, Bob, you have to admit, I mean, he's got his own problems with this. You know, he's out taking people to Mar-a-Lago to play golf. And who's paying for that? Who's getting the money for that? I mean, this gets just very murky when it intersects. But I don't want to go down that wormhole with you. What is our agenda? Can we just focus on, from an environmental perspective, one of the times we got together last time was the WOTUS conversation. Why don't we stay focused on that for a minute and drown out all the noise? Where are we at with WOTUS?
WOTUS has seen some movement in the last few weeks. I wrote a blog piece on this for our GCSA website that Trump issued on February 28th, an executive order, notice saying that the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers should review the Clean Water Rule, we commonly call it WOTUS, and publish for notice and comment a rule that either revises it or replaces it entirely. Now, an executive order to spur rulemaking is kind of like a New Year's resolution. It really has no practical input. It does not allow, it's not binding in any way. It's like me saying I'd like to lose some weight this year. I still have to go through the motions of getting on a diet and increasing my exercise in order to do that. But what it does provide us is with a statement of the priorities of the administration and where it sees the Clean Water Rule in that level of priority. So the fact that this administration put out an executive order after just 39 days in office tells us that a review of WOTUS is very high up on their list, and that makes us very happy. We've opposed WOTUS as it was written. The GCSA has been upfront about this. We support the goals of the Clean Water Act, but we feel that a rule has to be written that provides certainty and clarity to folks that work in the areas that our people do in terms of waters of the United States. And we would rather see a rulemaking process where we and other stakeholders have a seat at the table in order to make sure that this is a better rule.
Yeah, and so let's go with that, right? Because, you know, I live in Ithaca, outside of Ithaca, New York. This is a blue dot in an otherwise sea of red, if we characterize people by just the way they voted. Not maybe what they care about, but just the way they voted. And so a lot of people, I think immediately get, oh, he's going to gut the EPA. And you certainly see some movement with the auto manufacturers. You see that maybe the spurring of the coal industry, some of these, gyrations he makes in particular directions. But I keep reminding people, because when WOTUS was happening, right, I'm a member of this golf industry, and I think the waters and lands should be, appropriately protected. But even myself, When I saw what the EPA was doing with the way they were advocating as an agency to get citizens to write letters like that, they were scolded for that by the GAO. The sort of overreach in some ways, it's like, man, there's a lot of things you can be fussing about. Where are you going with this? And I like to remind, I believe we should have liberal environmental policy. I believe the environment should be protected sometimes at the expense of economic growth. I'm one of those Gallup people. But I'm sort of wondering, that's what I usually say. Is that how we view WOTUS? It seemed like a mess from the get-go.
It did. And unfortunately, there were so many parts of it that left our members in the dark as to whether or not they would be required to get a permit or not for their activities on and around their courses, meaning questions of whether an ephemeral drainage, for example, something that you'd see only with an intermittent flow, whether something like that would be considered a water of the United States under the Clean Water Act, whether a trench or a ditch that you dig, which has a concrete bed at the bottom, something that you and I might say is that's man-made, it's not a water of the United States, but yet the definition of tributary under WOTUS includes bodies of water such as that. Those were just two of the examples of the uncertainty that we were facing as an industry under WOTUS that could lead us into some very bad areas in terms of trying to figure out whether we could move dirt on our courses or whether we could put inputs down on them.
Right. And that's where it got murky. And I guess, I'm going to pivot right to you, Michael, halfway through this conversation now that we've sort of talked about WOTUS. And I believe off air, I was saying to you earlier, You know, I believe that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but what I have seen in my 30 years of watching this is that there is an agenda at a federal level that gets followed. But a lot of these environmental issues, especially in my experience in, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, the state of Michigan, in New York now with Long Island and water quality in the Chesapeake Bay, I've been in places where local stuff has led to sort of problematic issues. Not broad-based like Bob and I are talking about with WOTUS, but are you discussing at least already with your ambassadors, you know, what you know, obviously we have an agenda there, but there could be in many communities a blowback from the perception that, you know, they're going to quote-unquote gut the EPA. What are you thinking about locally for this conversation?
Well, it's a great question, Frank, and it ties into something I wanted to mention. You know, we beat up on the EPA a little bit over something like WOTUS, but we should also say that we fully support the EPA in their efforts, such as those within the Office of Pesticide Policy. Every chemical, every fertilizer that is applied to a golf course has gone through a strenuous registration process within the EPA. So anything that's on the market has had the rubber stamp of the EPA stating, yes, this product can be used in a healthy and environmental way that's pro-stewardship. If used, you know, in this amount, this time of year, with these specific instructions. So we fully support that type of effort, and we love that. And we have to, often mention that and remind folks at the local level when these things are being applied in communities that they've been EPA approved.
Right, but wait, now I got to bug you, Michael, and this is what you get for working with these guys for just a few minutes. People don't care. When you use the word EPA rubber stamp, let me tell you how many environments I've been in where people have these conversations. And the EPA, I'm not talking about the people who wear the gas masks and the rubber suits and go to meetings, you know, political meetings. I'm talking about just your average person now. I believe we've become sufficiently suspicious of science in particular. I don't want to say all business, but certainly suspicious of science with maybe a little bit of suspicions about business, that just because the EPA, quote unquote, rubber stamps it, Michael, I'm with you 100% on that issue. It's fairly it's a big scrutiny, and chemical companies have responded by going to developing reduced risk chemistries simply because the cost and time to bring a molecule to market is so cost prohibitive. And I think from a pesticide perspective, everybody's starting to see the light at the end of that tunnel for many pesticides that, you know, are high rate, long persistence. Those things are not going to be around long. So to put that EPA thing in context, I agree with you. We do support that. But locally, is the agenda, I guess let's move it this way. Is the agenda the same for you as it is for Bob in Washington? It's just you're sort of making sure that that stuff is happening, what, in not just with the Congress, but you're also working with their state assembly person, maybe their state senator, maybe their county legislator. If you were working in Westchester County with the Big Shot Golf guys down there, they have county legislators that can impact them. So how are you doing this locally with these issues?
Well, all of our efforts revolve around our priority issues agenda, which we put together every year. We have a government affairs committee at GCSAA that kind of determines the issues that are hot topics and things that we ought to be focusing on. And those are relevant at the federal level, but they're also relevant at the state and local level as well. And what I'll tell you is with our grassroots ambassadors, you know, a lot of times they get involved initially at the federal level because they want to work with Congress, but they enjoy it so much that they also get involved then at the state and local level as well. And we're really happy to see that. Now, with the ambassador program, we reserve that for superintendents specifically, but we have a larger advocacy network that also brings in local chapter involvement. It brings in our industry partners, and it brings in educators from universities and PhDs around the country, such as yourself. And so when we come together in a collective effort and we have a unified message and we can tell a good story about golf and talk about the sound science that's behind our practices, we think we can have a real impact at the local level.
One of the activities in the Government Affairs Office, in addition to the congressional operation we have in D.C. and additional to the grassroots program that we've talked about, is this participation in this integrated lobby day or advocacy day efforts for golf over from April 24th to the 26th this year, National Golf Day. So, Michael, describe to me how you view National Golf Day.
Well, National Golf Day is a really exciting program and initiative that's been around for 10 years now. This is the 10th year consecutively that we've hosted National Golf Day, where we take members to Washington, D.C. for a fly-in, and we do it in conjunction with our other allied golf associations, such as the Club Managers Association, the World Golf Foundation, Golf Course Builders and Architects. Some of those groups we partner with in putting on National Golf Day. And it's really our opportunity to go to Washington, go directly to Congress, Capitol Hill, the administration, and talk about all the good things happening in golf. So this year, because it's our 10th year anniversary, Hava McKeel, our department director, had the fantastic idea of putting together a community service project in Washington, D.C. That's going to happen on Tuesday, April the 25th. And we're going to be on the National Mall, and we're working with Michael Stakowitz, who's with the National Park Service. He has a background as a golf course superintendent, and we're going to be doing turf grass restoration on the mall. It's really, really exciting.
Excellent. Michael is a listener and a guest of Frankly Speaking. We recorded a show with him. Yes, Michael is a former golf course superintendent, a very thoughtful guy. And one, so this is an interesting community service project. They just spent a fair amount of money fixing up the National Mall. That's going to be really nice for you guys to get out there and talk about that real new project that Michael's managing. I think that's a really smart idea. Do you have, obviously, do you have particular congressional, I guess I want to say, when you're doing that, do you invite congressmen and their aides to be part of that, or do you just do it and invite the media? How does that work when you stage such an event?
Yeah, we definitely invite members of Congress and staff to be a part of that. We also have our lobby day, which happens the next day on Wednesday, the 26th. We'll have a set up in the Rayburn House Office Building foyer, where members of Congress and staff can come by throughout the day, have media opportunities there, maybe do a swing analysis. We have our Republican versus Democrat putting contest once again. So it's kind of nice, the things from the game of golf that we weave into it. But we absolutely invite anyone and everyone to be a part of that. In terms of the community service project, I mean, this is just a great opportunity for our superintendents to put their expertise to work on, you know, a piece of property that's also known as the nation's front yard. I mean, it's really fantastic, you know. So we're going to be doing some aerating, overseeding, all the things you might do on a golf course, but doing some nice landscape restoration to beautify the National Mall. So we're really excited about that, and we're also in the process of lining up all of our congressional meetings on the Hill for Wednesday, as I mentioned. So last year, I think we had around 160 congressional meetings that we did. We're going to have that plus more this year. So it'll be a busy few days, but we're really excited about it.
And so when you put the team together, now you said the CMMA, the World Golf Foundation, the architects, the builders, when you then go to those 160 meetings, so that guys get a little look at how this sort of works mechanically, do superintendents go with Rhett or Hava or you or Bob? Or how do you deploy a superintendent as part of a team with a general manager, with a World Golf Foundation member? I would imagine with a sort of very competent public or professional golfer. Is it teams that you go to these meetings, or are things set up around the strategic agenda that you have? How do you go about, first of all, sort of getting in those meetings organized?
Yeah. Mostly the way that we formulate that is it's still kind of based on location and where you're from, because we know that members of Congress want to hear from their constituents first and foremost. So, you know, if you're from New York and you attend National Golf Day, well, we're going to try to set up meetings with Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, and maybe whoever your congressman is as well. And then, yeah, you go collectively with the group. So our superintendents can touch on, you know, what the issues that impact them in their daily lives, which might be slightly different from those that are part of another golf association that's there with us. But we do a pretty good job of tying the whole message together and having a unified voice.
Right, because I do think that you know, no matter who's in the White House, if a Republican agenda is currently what we are sort of working under, right? Everybody's working under an agenda now set primarily by Republican strategists. I mean, we'll call them that broadly. And in general, you would imagine that they're going to be business friendly, right? So are superintendents able to really put what they're doing in the context of a small business? Do the CMAA guys do it? Because, you know, at the end of the day, the operators are a bunch of small business people, right? And I think I got to believe that's something that no matter who you voted for, you want to see your local small businesses succeed. And there certainly is the perception that many of the sort of, well, let's just put it this way, under the Democratic agenda, that maybe there were less business friendly things. How about specifically in the weeds on this, Michael? What would you say?
Well, most golf courses certainly are small businesses. Our 2016 president of the board was a guy named Pete Grass from a 9-hole course in Montana. And you think he has a big crew working his golf course? I don't think so. So our superintendents really, they fit into that small business frame, and they deal with issues that affect all small businesses, such as you know, labor force. Where do you find workers that are interested in a seasonal job outdoors? I mean, it's a challenge. So those are things that all of our superintendents can speak to, and then all the other things they have to comply with on the environmental side or other areas as well.
And so, Bob, let me bring you into the conversation with this question, right? Since you're sort of, you know, the guy, our guy in Washington, so to speak. And when all of these people come and, you know, do their thing for a couple of days, you're left to deal with, you know, from our end, at least one of the, you know, leading our agenda forward. Is this just one of the many strategies that you use, I guess, is part one? And part B, since Michael mentioned it, I'm particularly interested how the golf industry, what our agenda and what our platform has on sort of, where are we at on immigration? I mean, certainly we know the golf labor force throughout much of the United States is made up by immigrants, not from here. So let's take the first part. How does Lobby Day, how does Golf Day fit into your overall agenda for what you're trying to accomplish in Washington?
Well, you know, Mike mentioned he used to work for Senator Inhofe. I used to work on the Hill for Senator Corzine of New Jersey. So I sat at a lot of the meetings on the other side of the table of these kind of things we're trying to do right now. And I can tell you that our efforts as on Golf Day, our fly-in, which is going to be one of the largest ones we've ever had this year, definitely resonates. I mean, one of the rules, no matter who's in the White House and no matter who's in Congress, is that all politics is local. They see the locals' connection. They get it. Even a Democrat or a Republican, pick your issue. They can't say no to listening to us. That's what they're elected to do. So it helps me make the point, even with some of these tough offices, even with some of these tough members of Congress, to remind them that they met with somebody. And the contact doesn't end after the 26th. We're going to have these same members of our association back us up on some of these requests and meetings and issues that we're talking about throughout the remainder of the year. And remind them that they've spoken to us so that the member gets it, that what they're doing in D.C. has an impact back home.
That's such a great, you know, that is actually a perfect way to end our conversation. And I'm a little bit afraid to ask again about that immigration question. Is that a deep hole or is it just covered by, you know, we're going to comply with whatever the labor laws are we're going to say?
Frank, and I'll just hit the one issue of immigration that we work on very closely, which is the H-2B visa workforce issue. So these are people that come to the United States to work here and then they go back to their home countries. These are jobs that otherwise go begging at golf courses and other industries around the country. We have to go through a vigorous process to vet the people that come in. We support efforts to continue the H-2B visa program. We support efforts to work around the cap involved by bringing back some of the trusted, reliable returning workers and have them apply outside of the cap. Golf course superintendent is doing what we can to help our members. Our trade association is doing what we can to help our members be able to fill their ranks and keep their courses open using this.
Yeah, I mean, that's exceptionally well put, Bob. That is a really nice way to characterize it, because, again, it comes back to it that these are jobs that are going to go wanting otherwise. These are trusted and reliable people that have culturally, in many cases, when I visit golf courses that have a primarily immigrant workforce, maybe that avail themselves of H2B, they tend to be families of people. And so, you know, that's the thing that I think I'm really so pleased to hear you say that, because I believe the golf industry not only is dependent on it, but it really has become part of our fabric as the golf industry. I visit so many courses where the superintendent, who otherwise wouldn't have a clue on how to deal with immigrants culturally, has really embraced it. And you see the warmth and affection these guys have for their workforce and their families and their relatives and their friends. It's something that I'm pleased to see we continue to support. And I'm assuming, one more time back to you, Michael, that obviously this H2B is going to be part of the agenda on National Golf Day?
It will be part of our agenda. And before we run out of time, Frank, I did want to make one last plug for the ambassador program, because we currently do, and I'm not sure how far your audience reaches. I assume it's mostly in the northeastern part of the country, but we do have ambassador slots.
Nah, we're international now, brother. We're spanning the globe here.
Hey, fantastic. We had Canadians at our boot camp this year, so we're international as well. But we've got openings currently with members of Congress from New York, New Jersey, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine. So we'd love to get anybody that's interested in advocacy and is a superintendent engaged and involved in the Grassroots Ambassador Program. We have openings for them now, so we'd love to fill those spots and get people signed up.
Is there a place they can go to the website or somewhere otherwise they could go if they hear this program and want to do it? Where can they go to get involved in National Golf Day?
Two places I'll mention. We just relaunched the GCSAA website, so that's gcsaa.org. The website has a new look and feel to it. It's much more mobile friendly. I would highly encourage your listeners to go there and see the new website. And contact me directly, and I'll give you my email address. It's mlee, that's M-L-E-E, at gcsaa.org, if they're interested in joining the Grassroots Ambassador Program. And if they would like to attend National Golf Day, they need to go to We Are Golf. That's the coalition group that that puts on National Golf Day. They can find more information there, and they can register online.
Great. Michael Lee, Bob Hyland, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me here on Frankly Speaking. It is always a pleasure to hear from really smart people being very thoughtful and professional about issues that I think are absolutely vital to us as an industry, golf as an industry. And my favorite part is that comment you made, Bob, about all politics being local, that it is actually helping these people that are part of a local community in the golf world, that we're holding up our end of the bargain, both environmentally, labor-wise. As I said, I'm very proud to be part of watching you guys do your work, because I know that you wouldn't be espousing things that none of us couldn't be proud of. So thanks for joining me, and I'll look forward to chatting with you guys in the future. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining me on Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers, and always Frankly Speaking.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.